Our next speaker today is Terence Sijnowski. He is from the Salk Institute, and he is here to tell us why reverse engineering brains is within reach. And he's going to have a debate a little later about that with someone who disagrees with him. So please welcome to the stage, Terence Sijnowski.
So great to be here. The talks this morning and this afternoon have been really stimulating, and I'm going to be building on things that you've already heard about. And in a sense, you've already seen a preview in the last talk, because I agree with most of the presentation. And in fact, I'm going to be picking up on some of the details. So first of all, let me ask the question, what does it mean to reverse engineer the brain? So the National Academy of Engineering has developed a series of grand challenges that are meant to inspire the next generation of engineers. And I was at one of the summit meetings that was held at Duke. It was last spring, and it was an unusual audience because half the audience were deans of engineering, and I had no idea there were that many deans. And the other half were young students from Duke and neighboring universities, engineering majors. And it was really sociologically a very interesting case where there's the extremes of people who have made it to the top of their profession and probably were looking back over their previous era, and they're the young students who are just getting started, and they're looking forward. And so the talks spread over a whole set of different areas. And in fact, you can see the list here. You probably can't read them. It ranged from nuclear fusion, right, which is clearly would be a fantastic engineering event if we could create energy on that scale, down to nuclear terrorism prevention, that is. And squeezed in here is reverse engineering the brain. And it was clear from the response I got after the talk, I started out by saying that when I went to school, like you were, students, I computed with two sticks of wood. And all of the deans smiled. And of course, the students were dumbfounded when I said it was a slide rule. And the students had never even seen a slide rule, let alone know what you could do with it, because, of course, it's an obsolete technological artifact. But that's the divide. And the question is, well, what kind of a computing device is the brain? And that's really the issue, is trying to understand the actual function of the brain, why it's here. And by the way, there's no reason whatsoever why evolution would have ever made it possible for us to understand evolution's function. You know, in other words, we shouldn't assume we understand ahead of time how it works. We really have to be very open to surprises, as we have many, many other areas of science, physics, chemistry, and so forth. And just because we have intuitions about psychology doesn't mean we know anything about psychology. Now, I agree with Ray Kurzweil that understanding the brain, and ultimately ourselves, may be the problem of the 21st century that would really be a prime one for science to attack. I think the time is right. And the question is, exactly how do we go about doing that? Now, nothing makes sense except in the light of evolution. This is something that Theodos Dobzhansky once pointed out in the respect to other areas of biology, and there's no reason why that shouldn't apply to the brain as well. Evolution goes back billions of years, billions and billions of years, which, by the way, apparently Carl Sagan never actually said, on air at least. But it's only, we're talking about human intelligence, or general intelligence. We're talking about the last few million years at most. In fact, real, in terms of technology, it's only been around for a few tens of thousands of years, right? So this is really kind of the last few microseconds of this timeline here with respect to the total fraction of the time that's spent evolving us. Now, one of the remarkable things that we've discovered in the process of sequencing the human genome is the fact that most of the parts list in our body, including the brain, was evolved long, long ago, back billions of years ago. In fact, if you look at bacteria, they have many of the same ion channels and phosphorylation mechanisms, and you'll be hearing more about that, that are found in cells today. What's happened is diversification. Many more different types of channels that have evolved through duplication and specialization. And so, in a sense, if we look at mechanisms, we really have a long history here that we're building on. And now the question is, what about the great diversity of different species out there, tremendous number of, there's insects, there's mammals of all sorts of shapes and sizes, humans. One of the great and amazing discoveries that was made is that body forms, segmentation, is controlled by the same set of genes, whether you're an invertebrate or a vertebrate or a human. In other words, the genes themselves that created us during development, they are conserved as well. There's a tremendous amount of conservation. And I believe that the same thing will hold true as we understand more and more about the brain. Now, the central question is whether we can really make progress with the problem of understanding how something as complex as the brain works with the present tools. Now, let's take ourselves back in our time machine to 100 years ago. Suppose I was giving you a talk. I wouldn't be using a laser pointer, but perhaps I'd be giving a talk at the Royal Society to distinguished scientists. And the topic would be, can we reverse engineer life? So we're talking about 1910. Well, quite a bit was known in 1910, but very little about life except the phenomenology. A lot was known by that time from Darwin and many others. We knew a lot about evolution in terms of the different species and how they're related to each other, but we had no clue whatsoever what mechanisms were involved. And in fact, if you go back and read the literature, it's really confusing because, there were competing hypotheses about vitalism, some substance that was present perhaps in living things that weren't present and things that were not living. And it was very, very, as I said, a confusing time because of the fact that it predated DNA. Now, Francis Crick, a former colleague of mine at the Salk Institute, was involved in at a time when it was possible for the first time because of technological advances in X-ray crystallography to be able to work out the structure of DNA. And this is taken from the 53 Nature paper with Watson and Crick. And in a sense, before that paper, trying to come up with a model or a understanding of the process of life was more or less impossible. Even if you were super intelligent, I don't think you could have made much progress. The closest person I think that did make progress was Schrödinger, and he talked about an aperiodic crystal in his book, What is Life? But I think that the process really required getting the technological techniques available to actually go in and find out, what was at the molecular basis of life. And one of the things that came out of that was the fact that there was a structure, the double helix, that was a model, after all. This was a physical model. And in fact, they had the different base pairs machined from plates of metal that were put together to show the spacing between the two different axes of the helix. So that model also contained the principle of life, the fact that there were two strands, and the fact that it might replicate this way, and the fact that evolution might occur by mutating some of these base pairs. In a sense, that was all present. And it took, of course, the next 50 years to work out the details. But in a sense, now no one asks the question of what is life anymore, because we now more or less know to a first approximation. And in fact, going to the quote from Richard Feynman, Craig Venter announced just within the last few months that he has synthesized a new organism, a new form of bacteria that never existed before. Now, that's not quite accurate, because if you look at what he actually did, what he did is he took a bacteria, took its nucleus out, not nucleus, because they don't have nucleus, but he took out the DNA and inserted a synthesized DNA, a concoction of genes that were the minimal number that you needed in order to sustain replicating life. And then he injected it in. So in a sense, what he really did was to create a transvestite version of life. Because it turns out that everything around the DNA is also essential and important. So I think that the real advance is going to come in techniques. And there's been, as you heard recently, the very last lecture from Dennis, that there's been an explosion of advances. And no one technique is going to give you all the answers. This is a space-time diagram showing you the different spatial levels from the very molecular level down here to the level of the whole brain at the very top, 7 orders of magnitude of spatial scale. And on the time axis here, from milliseconds all the way to months and years, on this space-time diagram, we can put different techniques that allow us to collect information at different time scales. For example, single units, spike trains from single neurons, we can record from them with a certain spatial scale, namely a few microns. But in fact, over very long periods of time, from milliseconds up to hours in some cases. So we can really see how each of these approaches to understanding the brain gives us a very limited little window, right? And we're trying to understand a very complex system on the basis of up until recently, recording from one neuron at a time from the brain. And you know, you can tell from the number of neurons it's going to take you a long time to make progress there. But more recently, using imaging techniques, we can record using fMRI and PET from the whole brain at a low spatial and temporal resolution. And more recently, with optical techniques, we can record from hundreds of neurons at millisecond timescales. So it's really, the things are advancing. And perhaps the most important technique that was introduced just within the last few years is the ability not just to record from the neuron, but to manipulate it. And that's really going to be the edge of the wedge that will allow us to actually test hypotheses. And not only just stimulate neurons, we've been able to do that for a long time, but to do that in a controllable way, to controllably either stimulate or silence specific subtypes of neurons, such as inhibitory interneurons. And I think that having that ability now, just within the last year or two, routinely now and working in the lab, is going to really allow us to do the critical experiments needed to actually test a lot of our theories. Now, here I've stripped it down to just the spatial scale to give you an idea of the different levels, molecules up to the entire central nervous system. And one of the things you have to keep in mind is that if someone tells you they have a model of the brain, you should ask them a model of what part of the brain and what level. Because models can be built, for example, for the synapse, which look completely different from a model, for example, of the visual system, this hierarchy of levels that you've been hearing about. The primitives, the actual variables that are used in the model are quite different. Typically what happens is that all of the variables at one level, like the synapse, are collapsed into one or two parameters at the next level. And we need all of those levels. We need to build bridges between the levels. And that's the way we're going to make progress through figuring out how each one of these levels contributes to some computational primitive that ultimately will allow us to understand the algorithms that the brain is running. Now, let's look at a few numbers. Now, this is a rough estimate. No one's actually counted the total number of neurons in the brain, but it's estimated there are about 100 billion. Back when I was learning neuroscience, the textbook said that there were 10 to the 10th neurons, so 10 billion. And no one had actually looked at the cerebellum, and they realized that there are actually even more of these small granule cells in the cerebellum than there are in the entire rest of the brain. So the next edition of the textbook said there are 10 to the 10th neurons, of which 10 to the 11th are in the cerebellum. Now, 100 billion is a big number. And I've always thought of it as an astronomical number. However, if I had a dollar for every neuron in your brain, I couldn't cover this year's national budget deficit. In fact, if I had $10 for every neuron in your brain, I couldn't cover the TARP that was passed by Congress, right? The trillion-dollar TARP. So that's a large number, but you know, because there are 100 billion stars in our galaxy, so it feels like a big number. It's not really that big compared to the number of synapses. And the synapse is the computational primitive in the brain. It's not the neuron, it's the synapse that's really doing all the heavy lifting, and there are an awful lot of them, 10 to the 15th. They're organelles that were specialized for transmitting information from one neuron to the next. These are chemical synapses. They release neurotransmitter, and these are the ones that have the most highly evolved signaling systems, but based on the primitive mechanisms that are found in almost all cells. Now, Ray Kurzweil, in his lecture, mentioned a number which he thought would be sufficient to simulate the brain, and he gave a number 10 to the 16th, and I think that's a reasonable number for the bandwidth. If you count the number of spikes, for example, which all neurons use for transmitting information back and forth, they use a digital all-or-none code, but the timing of the spike can be varied. And it's estimated that every spike carries a couple bits, so we can be generous and say that there's about a 10 to the 16th spikes per second, because each fires at a few spikes per second on average. However, what this leaves out is the fact that in each synapse, there are hundreds of unique proteins that have multiple states, and we really don't understand the full complexity of what's in a synapse and what it's capable of computing. So there's a big question mark at the bottom there. So for the rest of the lecture now, instead of giving you a general big picture, I want to zoom down, and I want to give one success to give you an idea of what I think reverse engineering of the brain might lead us into. And this is, the story starts out in Randolph Menzel's lab, who's an invertebrate neurobiologist who studies bees. Bees are the champion learners amongst the invertebrates. They can land on a flower, and if there's good nectar, they can learn to associate both the shape of the flower, the color of the flower, and the odor of the flower, so that the next time, with one trial learning, they can go back to the same flower. However, they also have to be very nimble, because if they come back the next day, those flowers may have already bloomed, and now they have to learn a new flower. So there's a tremendous amount of learning and unlearning that needs to take place. And this was really something that Carl von Frisch really studied as an ethologist, an animal behavior person. But it wasn't until neurobiologists were able to record from single neurons. This is a bee head, stabilized. This is the proboscis, and the experiment is the following. You give the bee an odor, and nothing happens. But if you give the bee an odor and then put on a drop of sugar water, the bee will put out its proboscis. And it's responding to the sugar water in an unconditioned way. Now, here's the experiment. You give the bee the same odor, and lo and behold, he puts out the proboscis, or she. This is a worker bee, though. It's a he. And that's called classical conditioning. And Randolph Menzel recorded from different neurons in a circuit from the olfactory system into the bee brain. And what he and Martin Hammer discovered was there was one particular neuron that's outlined here. This is about a millimeter across, called the ventral unpaired medial MX1 neuron. And he discovered by recording from the cell body that this neuron responds directly to the sugar solution. Right? So here's the experiment that they did. What they did was to, instead of pairing the odor with the sugar solution, they paired the odor by injecting current into the neuron and firing it as if the neuron were getting the sugar solution. And they found that using this artificial stimulation, they could condition the bee to put out its proboscis the next time the bee got the odor. So what this suggests is that this neuron, VOMX1, is a unique neuron, may be important for carrying the information to the brain that allows the bee to learn very rapidly. And it carries a neurotransmitter called octopamine. And it goes into regions that are both sensory, memory, the mushroom bodies, and also the motor areas. It really is distributed very broadly through the whole brain. Now, back in 1994, Peter Day and Reed Montague and I developed a very simple model of bee learning based on that one neuron, VOMX1, and we use the temporal difference learning algorithm, the same one you heard from Dennis's talk. Temporal difference learning is an online version of a computer science algorithm called dynamic programming that goes back to Bellman. And it's an algorithm that allows you to compute what the optimal path is between your starting position, and some goal. And there could be a whole sequence of decisions you've got to make along the way. What's the optimal set of decisions? Especially if you're dealing with an uncertain world where there's variability and probabilities, it's a difficult problem to work that out. But temporal differences, and the problem is that the Bellman algorithm requires you have complete knowledge of all the probabilities in every possible state. And the problem is, of course, you never have that. We never have. We don't come into the world with a complete knowledge of what's going to be out there. In fact, nature couldn't have guessed. But with this temporal difference algorithm, if you just learn a little bit in every step, you can show you can converge ultimately to the optimal path. So we apply temporal differences to this P neuron, which is, in a sense, predicting the future. It's telling you how good a particular sensory state is, and it's updating the weights, the connection strengths between the sensory input and this P neuron to allow you to be able to predict whether you should land on the yellow flower or the blue flower by projecting that estimate to the motor system. Now, the question is, we were able to predict, or the model was able to predict in great detail the behavior of the bee. Not just the fact that it learned, but the fact that it was risk aversive. A bee will prefer a steady one, say a half a micron, half a microliter of sugar solution. If you give it a constant amount of sugar on each trial, it would prefer that to a flower that gives 50% of the time one microliter of solution and 50% of the time no solution. So that would mean, on average, you get the same, half a microliter, but one is a constant and the other one is unpredictable, it's probabilistic. And the bee will prefer the sure thing. And the algorithm gives precisely the same behavior. So we were able to predict not just the learning, but also the response to an uncertain environment, and also even the variance that is found from the experimental recordings. Now, okay, that's bees, and the question is whether or not this algorithm, temporal differences, really could it be one that's more universal? I mean, a bee brain is completely different from ours. It only has about 1 million neurons, and there are these unique neurons. Each neuron in the bee brain has to do a lot of duties. Every single part of it is specialized, so it's hard to imagine that something that was specialized many millions of years ago, hundreds of millions of years ago in the bee, would actually be found in the brain. But lo and behold, there is another neurotransmitter system, that's the dopamine system, which is another amine, which is in the same family as octopamine. And these dopamine neurons that are found in the brainstem project throughout the entire cortical mantle and also the basal ganglia, which are the region in between where a lot of these decisions are made. And interestingly, the dopamine system is the locus of all addictive behavior. All addictive drugs work by either releasing dopamine or blocking the reuptake of dopamine. Drugs like cocaine, nicotine, and even crackberry work through the dopamine system. It's a very powerful system. And animals that are given the choice to self-stimulate the release of dopamine will do that at the expense of all other behaviors, including food and sex, to show you how powerful this could be. Well, we think that now experimental evidence from Wolfram Schultz's lab, Wolfram is the one on the right, went into the lab and tested this theory. And you saw in the last lecture that the prediction of the model, which is that the stimulus will come to represent and predict the future reward, and the fact that it's done through this difference, this this positive and negative cancellation, and this is a very rare event where someone actually goes and tests a theory or a model in an experimental lab. I mean, it really is very, the two cultures, the empirical culture and the theoretical culture, generally have difficult time talking to each other. But this is a great success story where they did come together and they found the smoking gun. So this is really good news. And this tells us that we actually have hope that similar successes will occur in the future. But what good is this? Can we actually build something from this? After all, it's not just the brain we're interested in doing. We want to build machines that can do things like the brain. Well, about the same time that we were working on these temporal difference models, Jerry Tesoro, who is a former postdoc in my lab who had worked on a neural network model that played backgammon, realized that he could apply temporal differences to backgammon. And the problem with the supervised learning, which is what we used before, was that you had to have an expert teacher to tell you what the best move was. But what if you don't? Can you make progress? Well, what he did was two things. He said, let's let the game play itself. And number two, let's use temporal differences to assign what's called the temporal credit assignment problem. The only feedback you get, the game got, was whether or not who won at the end. And that has to be backchained to the beginning of the game to see whether or not a move was good or bad. Now, this might seem very unlikely to work because there are so many moves in the game. And also, if you know backgammon, it's a race to the finish. You throw the dice to decide how far to move your men. And therefore, it's a very difficult game to solve in any deterministic way. You've got to use stochastic methods. Well, to make a long story short, TD Gammon started playing itself. After 300,000 games, it was beating Jerry consistently. He's a strong intermediate player. So he brought in some experts from New York, in particular Bob Roberti, who wrote the books on positional game playing for backgammon. So he knew what he was talking about. And surprisingly, in 51 games, it did pretty well. It only lost about a quarter a point per game. Or it was winning roughly, I guess this would be 1 point per game. So losing roughly, I guess it was doing three quarters, as well as the experts. So he let it run more, it improved, and it brought back another group of experts, and it was doing better. It cut back its loss to about a half. And finally, he upgraded the network that he was using to learn. Bob Roberti came back, and it fought him to a standstill. In 40 games, it was pretty much in the noise. And Roberti was just amazed, because not only was it playing well, but it had discovered moves that no human had ever made before that proved to be better than the human positional play. And it did things that were really astonishing. For example, it learned concepts. That is to say, it learned the idea that you block at the beginning in order to prevent your men from coming through. And it learned the moment at which you should break your blockade and be aggressive and try to go for the race to the end. And this is very subtle, and it's very difficult for humans to learn exactly the right moment to do that. Not too soon, not too late. Otherwise, you lose the game. And TD Gammon had a superb sense of exactly when to do that. Now, this is learning now. The machine learned on its own. This is not a crafted, out-of-the-box algorithm like an expert system. In fact, about the same time, there was a program that IBM had, which was the Deep Blue, which beat the chess grandmaster. That got all the publicity, but that was an engineered game. That is to say, it was a chip that did a lot of moves, much more than human can do. It was very efficient. However, I think that the principle we're learning here is that we've created a little network that we didn't have to hand program to be able to learn this particular domain. It could have learned other games, right? It's an architecture that we've created that is general purpose in some sense. Of course, each network that you create or learn is special purpose. So, and that's also one of the important lessons from the brain, is that it's a collection of special purpose devices. It's not just a general purpose machine. It has a lot of special purpose parts in it. So finally, let me end by saying that where's the payoff going to be? In the immediate future, within the next 5 years, you are going to see these same algorithms apply to the radio spectrum. And this is already going into the FCC auctions for radio space. And the idea is to use the space more efficiently. If you can get more calls in the same bandwidth, you'll make billions of dollars. And this is now already happening. Simon Haken in 2005 wrote a paper in which he pointed out how this could be done very efficiently. And this is now one of the most cited papers in engineering. The same approach he has shown makes radar much more efficient. And you might ask, well, how could it do that? Well, it does it by experience, learning through experience under what conditions some calls fail or how much time to allocate for each call. You do that through accumulating experience, many, many examples of situations which may depend on the time of day, which may depend on the weather, a lot of other things. And this is going to go into cars to make driving more efficient in terms of which roads are the most efficient to use on any given time. And finally, and this is the one I think that's really remarkable, our power grid is basically 100 years old, hasn't been updated. The technology is really decrepit, and it's very inefficient. And I think that by creating a much more efficient way to allocate power and also to plan for the future, it should be possible to create a much better global system that is going to ultimately, I think, long before we have walking and talking robots, be able to create an environment that's a much better one to live in. Thank you, and I just want to thank all of the colleagues.